Good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us. How many people have attended an Issues and Ale event with us before? Well, yeah, you've been on a panel, Chastity. We pull her in all the time. So just to explain how this works, we look at these as sort of an informal town hall. And so we have a panel of people who can answer questions, but we really intend this to be a discussion with lots of audience participation. What we do ask, though, is that we respect one another's opinions, that we allow voices to be heard, otherwise these events don't work. So we know we involve beer in them, so that might make it a little dicey. We know we're taking a risk, but we do want to make it a relaxed, comfortable environment, a place where we can all share opinions, thoughts, ideas, etc. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce the people who have joined us tonight on our panel. You probably know some of them, at least. To my far left is Chastity Pratt, a reporter with Bridge Magazine, doing a lot of reporting on education and education in Detroit. Yes. And then next we have State Representative Sherry Gay Danyogo, representing the 8th District. She's also a steering committee member of the Coalition for the Future of Detroit School Children. Yay! A big applause. And then to my direct left is Armin Harachian, Vice President for K-12 Education at Excellent Schools Detroit. And then we have all of you. So there is a microphone. Steve, where did you go? Okay. So we'll be taking questions throughout the evening. If you have a question, raise your hand. We'll bring a microphone to you because this event is being recorded, so we want to make sure you are on a microphone so we actually pick up your question or comment. Okay? So, Chastity, I want you to sort of give us a framework to start this discussion by giving us a brief history of what's been happening recently in Detroit Public Schools.
I have covered the school district for more than 13 years, so I could talk the whole hour and a half about that, so just let me know if I'm being too long-winded. But if I were to give the highlights of the most recent history over the past generation or so, I would have to start with 1994, which is the year that in Detroit voters approved what was then the largest bond measure in the history of the state when they approved a $1.5 billion bond to improve school district facilities, build new buildings, and such. Let's fast forward to 1999. That's when the first state takeover happened. And if we're really being blunt, it really involved the fact that the school board at that point had not spent much of the bond money. So it was a lot about money. And since 1999, the state of Michigan has had direct oversight in some capacity of the Detroit Public Schools for all but 3 years. And from 1999 to present, as we saw the increase of number of charter schools in the city of Detroit, we saw the decrease in enrollment in the Detroit Public School District and the increase in the Detroit Public School District's deficit. Now, if school is about school, let's talk about academics. During that time, academics, we had some ups, we had some downs, nothing to really write home about as far as achievement in Detroit until we reached 2009. That was the year where everyone in the nation knew that Detroit school children scored the lowest of any school district, any city, on what is called the nation's report card. So I could just say, over the last generation, what we've seen is a lot of inconsistency in this Detroit Public School District, inconsistency in governance, inconsistency in what was even being taught in the classroom, to the point that what at one time had one school district, now we have three systems, if you will. A system of schools is what it's been called. Detroit Public Schools lost 100,000 students. Charter schools now are king. Most students in the city attend a charter school, more than 50%. And there's also a reform district called the EAA, Education Achievement Authority. We no longer have one school district. We have a system of schools. And we're going to see some more changes very soon.
So, Armin, at Excellent Schools Detroit, you all do a lot of assessment of schools, measuring how schools are doing. And within that context, how are Detroit schools faring right now? How are they working for kids and for families?
Well, just to feed off of what Chastity talked about. I mean, I don't think anybody in this room is surprised to know that Detroit schools, by the way, charter, DPS, EAA, schools aren't performing as high as any of us would like to see them. Based on lots of different measures. So at Excellent Schools Detroit, we measure schools based on test scores, like a lot of folks do. Just about across every one of those proficiency indicators, our outcomes in Detroit are about half of what you find statewide. So clearly, kids in Detroit are behind their peers statewide, the kids that they'll have to compete with when they leave the city. On a growth metric, if you look at how our kids improving over time, not very fast. And this was really alarming to us because there's been lots of reforms going on in the city. Lots of new charter schools, the EAA came up, lots of renaissance plans and reform plans for DPS. And not only are kids way behind, but they're not improving toward proficiency at a rate that would give you a whole lot of hope. That said, there's a few things that I would just point out about performance across the city. One is, we've got every type of school you could imagine in Detroit. All different kinds of themes, different sizes, different shapes, different everything. And we have not seen a single school figure this out. And by the way, not just in Detroit, but really nationally. So do we have a resource problem? Absolutely. Does poverty matter? Absolutely. So these things can't be dismissed when you look at the system broadly. And we should explore those things. The second thing I'd say is there are pockets of, you know, kind of emerging excellence across the city. So every time when we put our scorecard out, there are a number of schools in Detroit public schools, Bennett Elementary, Davison Elementary, Harms. There's lots of schools that we would point to and say, oh, that school is really overcoming these obstacles and doing great work. Detroit Merit, DEPSA, University Prep Science and Math. There are certain charter schools that are starting to do great work or having great outcomes on the edges. And even an EAA school like Brenda Scott, like if you walk into Brenda Scott, there's been some tremendous transformation going on in that school over the last few years. You haven't seen that at scale across any system, but you have seen that in pockets. So kind of final thing, though, is at the end of the day, if I were to measure our performance as a city, I would say the instability and kind of lack of a plan or vision really undermines any efforts. If every single year there's a new plan, if every single year there's funding cuts, if every single year there's this crisis popping up, these are things that are really hard to overcome as any individual school or educator in a classroom. So overall performance is weak and has really struggled to improve in the last few years.
Representative, I'll ask you to give us your thoughts about how Governor Snyder's recent executive order moving the school reform office into a department he controls might impact DPS. And we also know that today a new superintendent was announced. It's Brian Whiston, who was formerly with Dearborn Public Schools. So two major things happening this week.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate the history that Chastity gave us, which highlights how we got here. How we got to now a balloon deficit of almost $500 million. How we got here with this jump to get to race to the top funding, which has created the uncapped charter system that we have, which has created the instability. How we got here with a number of people who have made decisions that are not academicians that are not educational experts. So just having a context and understanding how we got here is important. The governor's decision was very disappointing to me to see that he remove the reform department into basically a budget and a management area that ultimately he could control. Especially given the fact that the goal in the conversation thus far has been to develop recommendations that would be considered as real meaningful solutions. To move the department and just say under the guise of control, or is it making sure that we engage academic experts? Looking at taking away the power of the State Board of Education, not just the city of Detroit. This is a Michigan issue. This is an education issue that everyone should be concerned about, and we need to make sure that educators, that content experts are not cut out of an opportunity to educate all 500-plus Michigan school districts. I just read the mayor's report myself, indicating that we have a new superintendent that was basically almost appointed unanimously. I thought through a number of conversations it would have been another choice. But I will be optimistic of what will take place. But I hope that it is a person that will stand on the principles of true educational experts leading education policy and what takes place in all of Michigan schools across the state.
We have a question. Steve, right there.
Was her question, where do you find the educational experts?
Indeed, ma'am.
Where do okay. You... Well, for one, I'm a certified science teacher. And a okay, good. Highly qualified science teacher. Also, I think that it's important that a number of our colleges and universities, that we establish better partnerships with them to work not just with Detroit Public Schools, with all of our schools across the state of Michigan. That is very key and important. But there seems to be a gap between that process. And so you have policymakers, and I'm sorry, for many of which, who couldn't line up a class of kindergartners to get to the restroom, more or less tell what happened in the classroom, who are making the decisions. And so we're here. Educators are here. That's one of the reasons I left the classroom to go to the legislature to really inform the process of how we get sound, competent, good pedagogical competency education policy. And so educators are here, but in many instances, they have been blocked and locked out of the process of participating. And so we need more educators to run for office to help change that.
It seems like one of the issues we... It seems like one of the issues we bump up against in this state, and Chastity, this is something you alluded to in your earlier comments, is there's this balance between educating kids and figuring out the money side of it. Why do you think there's such a disconnect between those two pieces?
Because we don't have an educational plan here in Michigan. You look at other states, and there is a clear path of where they're going, and then they figure out how to fund it. We do not have an educational plan in the state of Michigan. Yes, we have grade level content expectations. Yes, we have, you know, the M step. We have tests. But really, what is it that we are looking for from our students and then figure out how to fund it? That's how other states do it. We don't do it like that in Michigan. We say, well, here's how much money we have, and from there, good luck. And there's some standards we expect you to get to somehow.
It also seems like there's a problem with continuity. And when you look at a state like Massachusetts, where they found a plan that worked for them, they said, okay, we're going to stick with it. Not for 2 years, not for four, but for however long it takes to work. We may tweak things along the way, but there's been a lot of shifting of paths here in Michigan, and it seems like that's had a big impact on the way schools have or have not succeeded.
Has an enormous impact on how schools have succeeded. And I have to say that both Democrats and Republicans have to take the blame. You can't just change the label on governance or the name of a system and just make it better. Like Chastity says, there has to be a concrete plan that really will improve academic achievement in the classroom. And far too often, we have people who have found a way to feed off of the system as opposed to improving the system. And so it becomes very political. I'm very optimistic about our ability to move forward with even with the Rhodes Bill to look at the cost. How much does it really cost to educate a child? You look at right now, we have Detroit Public Schools for the
most.
Yes, it depends on the child. But let me just add to that. I like this lady. Let me just add to that. Detroit Public Schools, Michelle Fectu, she's not here, State Board of Education member, who also serves as a member with on the policy subcommittee with the Future of Detroit School Children. She brought to us information that highlighted the number of special needs children that Detroit public schools have, that charter schools have, and currently the EAA has. By the way, the EAA listed, their report said zero, and we know why that is, because they threw out the IEPs for those students, and that's why Helen Moore is suing them right now. But to move forward on this, the cost of educating our special needs population. I have a son who graduated K through 12 DPS who had an IEP. I know that it took additional support for his learning, but he graduated from Cass Tech. He went to South Carolina State University. He's trying to figure it out right now, but the point is, all children can learn, but there is a differentiated cost associated with children that have different needs, and that has not always been the case. So we need to really look at how much does it cost to educate children. Like Chastity said, we put the expectations, the glickies, on the system and say, this is what the kids have to do, but now this is how much money we're going to throw at it, and it may not be enough, that that's okay. And then we're going to create all these separate other programs that people start taking money from the classroom, and that's wrong. We have to look at really how much does it really cost to educate our children, fix the funding model, and make sure that we do that right. And I see a finance expert over there, right over there, Mike Adonisio.
Well, let's take a question in the back, Steve.
Yes, my name is Eric Foster. Two things. One, with respect to just the overall education paradigm, I think the problem is much longer than just what's taken place since the 1990s. Remember, in 1968, Detroit had 310,000 kids in the school system, and the Catholic schools had 63,000 in the city of Detroit. But then we started experimenting back then with the breaking up DPS, the first state effort to reform DPS, breaking it up into the area districts. So we've been working at this or playing with this since the 1970s, and it keeps getting worse. What was so wrong with the model that we had that was educating Black, White, Latino, and other kids at that time in DPS and in Catholic schools that were getting people to college, getting them graduated, to where now today we're in this model of attempting all of these different plans or efforts that don't seem to go back to the fundamentals of what worked back then for kids of color and for white families as well.
You know,
in different school districts.
That seems to come to something, Armin, you all have talked about at Excellent Schools Detroit about how fractured the Detroit public school system has become. And it sounds like that's what you're describing, sir. It sounds like that's what you're describing, this, the fractured nature of DPS.
Well, just going back to Chastity's point, Michigan education in general, mm-hmm. If we think about starting back in the 70s, you had a model that worked. Black, brown, and white kids were getting educated in Detroit in the Catholic and public schools, but you started experimenting with it back then. And you've continued efforts to try to, quote-unquote, through Blue Ribbon Commissions and others, fix something that was working. The principle of you come to school, we're going to educate you, you're going to learn, you worked. So all of these variations and special bells and whistles of it, that is just cosmetic to the real core. We're not having systems that just, and that's the question I have, what was wrong with what we were doing that we just can't go back to those as fundamental principles in the classroom and extracurricular activities?
Does anybody want to tackle that one? Why can't we go back?
Okay, how many, wait one second. Before my co-pilot over here grabs it. Can I see a show of hands of how many of you actually live in Detroit? Oh, that's good. I am very happy to see that. Well, how many teachers are in the house? Excellent, excellent. Right, right. Well, somebody can answer his question that goes back to that, because I wasn't teaching in 69, so maybe Baba Gibson can get to it.
Well, I personally, Eric and I have this conversation all the time. I personally don't buy the premise that things were so much better in the 70s. I mean, Detroit Public Schools had a lot of different resources, and we all are nostalgic about the times when we had more vocational ed and we had more variety of things that, you know, we taught in the schools. But, I mean, let's just be clear. When we had the whole... the big study that came out to show that we're not doing as well in America as the rest of the world, that tells us that we've not ever been ahead of the game, people.
Yeah, and I mean, we've also lost 100,000 kids in the city in just the last 15 years. So, I mean, the idea that DPS looks the same as it did 15 years ago, outside of all the interventions that have happened, there's this huge macroeconomics problem here, like 100,000 kids left the city. Now, clearly, it's a spiral, right? Like, DPS cuts, schools, you know, performance go down, and kids leave, families. Like, I get that it's spiraling, but the idea that DPS is serving even the same population that it did 20 years ago, it's not. This is a totally different environment that DPS is operating. And the other thing here is, like, you know, I have been as critical of charter schools as anybody, but I'll tell you, like 50,000 families and kids chose charter schools. Like they chose them, and we can be critical of the low performing charter schools, and I certainly am, or schools opening when they're not necessary. And but I believe that school choice is a right. Like it's like if a parent should have the right to choose a school for their kid, and at the end of the day, 50,000 kids did that. So we're one of the organizations that put out there that the fractured system isn't good for kids and the instability is a problem, and so we got to get our arms around that. At the end of the day, like charter schools and school choice has been driven by families in Detroit as much as anybody else.
But it was the nation. What year was that? A Nation at Risk. Was it 1983? A Nation at Risk told us then, Eric, that we were not doing as well as we thought we were. However, I definitely agree with you, Armin. I mean, we all know the population and cultural shift that we have seen in Detroit. We don't even have a handful of Catholic schools left to you know, take on the role that we had more than 100 Catholic schools at one time. We don't have but a handful. So we're dealing with a different time, a different generation, a different culture. And yes, school choice is something that is new that was not here a generation ago. We had busing back then, Milliken versus Bradley. So this is a different time. And so I think that we have to deal with it in different ways. And just on the school choice thing, remember, the state law does not say that school choice means that you're getting a better choice. It's just a different choice.
Exactly. So I don't really buy into the whole choice thing, and there's a lot of hands out there. So I think, I don't know how you're engaging the audience, but I want to make sure.
I'm motioning him in the back.
Okay.
So we'll come to the back, and then we'll come back up front.
Yes. All right. I'm an educator. Okay, and so there are a couple of things I have a problem with right now. Number one, we're dealing with equality versus equity. When you go to like an upper class white district in the state of Michigan, they are funded higher than a Detroit public schools. So again, the state is saying that equality is not an issue, it is equity. So I have a problem with that, with some of the statements up above. Number two is this. My child should be able to go to any school, anywhere, at any time, and it should be equitable for them to go there. It's not about the kids. It's about the state. And we constantly put this blame on the families. We constantly put this blame on the classes and the races and all this stuff. And it's not about races. It's not about class. It's about inequity. You know what? If you're impoverished, you love your children typically as much as someone that is upper class. And so for you to say that my child should have a school of choice, I agree, but why isn't your school of choice where your child should go versus where they could go because it's more equitable or more beneficial to you to go there? So why can't we make every school in the state equal? And not equal, but equitable based on need and diversity, because that's the true issue right now. It's not about equality, it's about equitability. So if my school is in a neighborhood in a certain demographics, why is that not beneficial for my child to go there? It's not about the kids. It's not about the family. It's not about a bad school. It's about bad government. It's about racism. Yeah. It's about classism. And we need to stop this garbage now. And we need to step it up in this city and in every city around the state, because each school is not equitable. The white schools get the most money, and the black schools get the least. And that needs to stop right now. It's not about charter. It's not about public. It's about being there for these people that go to these schools. And not my child versus yours. It's about this state and this government. And let's make it all ready to go for everybody so we can all be proud of our children, go wherever they go.
Okay, let's let the representative reply.
Well, bad government. There's a lot of bad government going on, so I agree with you. I just like to ask my friend to my right, where are all the charter schools in West Bloomfield? Where are all the charter schools in Novi and Troy? I don't think that they exist in the magnitude that they exist in the city of Detroit. And so if choice is good for Detroit, choice should be good for West Bloomfield. Is that right? So underperforming charters, we need to find a mechanism to close them, because they were supposed to be the solution for those parents who didn't have good public schools, if that was the premise that they were open. But I resist that notion, because I think that this whole concept of pushing DPS, indicating that it wasn't performing in the late 80s or the late 90s, is inaccurate. We have a Wayne State University president who took over DPS and went and testified in the state's legislature after being put in that role, indicating that he found that there were a number of high-performing schools performing at exemplary levels in the state of Michigan. But in order to take over the system, or in order to take over the largest state of Michigan system's dollars, you had to create this narrative. And so we've plummeted since then to the population shift in the 1960s, 69. One of the most difficult conversations that we don't want to have in the state of Michigan is about race. And so we have to start having better dialogue around race to even talk about how the population shifted, how many people left the city and moved to the suburbs. And that's okay, because now many African Americans have left the city and went to the suburbs, and now many of the suburbanites are coming back to the city. So it's okay. People have choice to live where they want to live. But we got to have dialogue around what really happened and the indicators of poverty. What's the correlation between poverty and bad government on top of that, creating the lack of academic achievement? Those are the things we really have to start addressing to really get to the core. So the profit centers that charters are making, they're profiting off of this emotional choice that they market. But in fact, all of the studies are showing, if you looked at this whole report that's been going forth from Detroit News and Free Press for a while, they're not a good choice.
I want to give Armin a chance to respond. Deep breaths.
If I have to be the charter advocate in this room, okay, so first of all, to the point that was made, the demographics across charter schools in Detroit, so they look just like DPS. They are serving just as poor of kids, just as black and brown kids. They look exactly the same as DPS across the board. Across the board. Now, hang on a second. So their special ed rates are much lower. But there's a reason for that, all right? Like, let me just be really clear. There's a reason for that. And you talk about broken legal situations here. Charter schools are their own LEAs. Each one of them are their own LEAs. DPS has 97 schools within its LEA. There are lots of DPS individual schools that don't serve a whole lot of special ed kids. That's because as an LEA, they get to send, they get to have, I'm sorry. So the way the federal law was set up was that every single LEA, those are the local education agencies that can accept money to serve special ed students, they have to serve legally every kid across the 13 categories of special education, right? And let me just tell you, I don't know this inside and out, but this is my understanding of this issue. All right, so let me just put that out there. But LEAs used to be the district, right? So as a district, Detroit Public Schools has 97 schools today, of which it can send students to that are special education. A single charter school has a single schoolhouse. There's no way that they can service special education students, especially the most severe cases, at a high level. Now, here's the broken part of it. We should fix that, because what's happening right now is they're either getting counseled out or they're getting whatever. Like, it's not working. It's not working. So I just, the special ed issue, you're right. Like, DPS is far more burdened with special ed students, but that's another part of the broken system that we're talking about. It wasn't set up to look this way. But I just want to push back on this charter thing one more time, real quick. There are charter schools in Plymouth. There are charter schools in Ann Arbor. There are charter schools a lot of places. And so, and by the way, like a lot of certified teachers in charter schools and lots of nonprofit charter schools. I'm not sitting here saying that we must fix the charter school problem. Charter schools that aren't performing as high as they should be closed. Absolutely. But we've got to move past. I'm going to just say this, my dad was a Detroit public school teacher for 25 years. Like, I've heard this debate for years. We've got to move past this anti-choice, anti-charter school debate. We got 50,000 kids in charter schools, and parents have the right to choose. Like, there is another debate here to be had, and it's not about whether choice in charter schools should be in Detroit.
Okay, keep it quick. I would invite people to BridgeMI.com. That's who I write for now, Bridge Magazine. We did a few stories last year that kind of dovetail on this topic. One, we did a story about adequacy versus equity. Are we supposed to fund our kids? Your kid gets $7,500 and yours and yours and yours. Or should we fund them? Your kid is special needs $12,000. Your kid is, poor, needs $15,000. Give them funding according to the needs according to the needs that they have, or just give everybody the same dollar amount. So we went into that in depth, and now there's an adequacy study that's being funded here in the state of Michigan. I also did a story a few weeks ago about governance. We're going to probably deal with the issue of governance here in Detroit again. But there's a study out there that shows if you look at 9 different cities that have changed their governance over and over again, you can't really attach any sort of governance to any academic improvement. But we spend a lot of time talking about that here in Detroit, don't we? And also, if you look at a story that we did at Bridge Magazine called Smartest Kids in the Nation, I talk about it all the time. We went to 4 different states and showed how some of them were performing way under Michigan, and now they've leapfrogged over Michigan on the nation's report card, and we looked at what they did. If you look at what other states have done, if you look at some of the research from Education Trust and other research foundations or whatever that are out there, people have figured this out. They have figured out what to do and how to do it, how to get kids of all different socioeconomic classes to perform. We haven't figured it out because we don't have a plan in Michigan. And as long as you don't have a plan on where you're going, where do you go?
Let's take a question here.
Well, I got the mic, so, either way, you're going to hold on. Okay. All right.
Got one mic, people. One mic.
My name is Victor Gibson. I have taught in Detroit public schools for 23 years. And to answer your question, Mr. Armand, are you an educator? Are you an educator? Yes or no? Do it real quick. Okay. Then I'm beginning to see where you lack in the understanding of what actually the issues are. See, you're looking at data generated in the last 12 years. So they took over 16 years ago. So any data that you're spouting out what's wrong and how bad. Engler, 1999. I know I got to update you because you're kind of young. 16 years will put you back a whole lot. But anyway, my point is this. I'm flipping. I don't mean to do that. But with all due respect, the historical nature of what's happening in Detroit public schools, most of you people don't even understand what has happened to us in those 16 years that Governor Engler proclaimed at the first takeover, I'm going to take Detroit Public Schools back 50 years from 1999. So now let's speed it up to 2015. The data that you are citing, these are the data generated under the takeover. These are generated under the experts. These are generated under the emergency managers. Even the ones that we, in the 2014 election, 2014 election, when we signed to get out the emergency manager, they turned around and put, you know, replaced PA 72 with PA 436. So even when the people say you are wronged us, and we did it the Democratic way, still your government, bad government, overrode the over 2,300, over the 250,000, 300,000 signatures to end this travesty. So now you all create this desolation. Now you cite what happened 5 years ago, 4 years ago, as if this is a systemic problem that has not occurred way before all this. All I'm saying to you is this. For all the Troy public schools you say the charters have, you're talking about people who are basically low income who cannot leave the district. They cannot leave the area where they are. So you're talking about McKenzie High School, a brand new high school built with our bond money that now that those people in those neighborhoods, they can't get on a cab. They can't take a bus. They must attend these local charter school setups because they have no other alternative. You say that's a choice? There was no choice in this. Where was the choice for them to say, I'm going to take my bridge card and take it out there in Farmington Hills? Take my child outside the district. Where's the choice in this? And there is none. So by creating this desolation, and you say 50,000 parents chose to send their kids, they had no choice, because if they did not, those same people who are receiving welfare aid, if they didn't send their kids to school, that's called educational neglect. They get thrown out or thrown off welfare just for not sending kids to school. So understand, this is not just a one aspect.
But what I want to say, let me jump in here. Excellent Schools Detroit, to be clear, what they do is assess all schools in Detroit, and they give a report card so that parents can look at how different schools are performing and make informed choices about those schools. So I just want to describe that. And Armin, I'll let you respond yourself as well. But there wasn't a question there. Was there a question? Or more of a statement? It's okay if it was a statement.
The question is this: how would all the EAA schools who've been listed as being dysfunctional, and all the EAA schools and all the data that they're not serving the welfare of children of color, how come they're now saying that all of a sudden they're being creative? That how are they going to lift these children up? I mean, how does the EAA validate its existence when this is very enrollment has dropped down?
So how does the EAA, but the EAA's enrollment also, I believe,
has dropped significantly.
But I thought there was a report out recently that said it also increased. It fell again.
Maybe okay. It has stabilized.
Okay, so
okay. You know,
go ahead, Armin. I'll let you respond.
Well, I respect everything you said. I appreciate it. There's no part of me that has said we should have an emergency manager for Detroit Public Schools. Like, that clearly hasn't worked. Let me say that hasn't worked, right? Four emergency managers. Like, I don't think anybody's proclaiming that we should do more of that.
We've going to let him answer, yeah. And then we will come here,
let's touch on this choice issue for a second. So I think you point out something really important here. We don't have real choice in Detroit right now, and it's largely because, so Excellent Schools Detroit realized this, right? Like, we put out a scorecard every year to a bunch of parents who said, that's great, but I got to navigate 100 different application processes, all these different deadlines. I have no idea why or why I didn't get accepted into a school. And I can't get there. I have no transportation to get there, right? So this is, and by the way, choice on steroids, like, that's not good either. So the pendulum swung big time here. There was a recent study out that showed that Detroit kids change schools at 2.5 times the rate of kids statewide. And by the way, because they keep closing and because we keep telling them to choose, I think when we're talking about bringing stability to the system, it's not just about governance. It's actually about helping parents say, listen, you've got a kid going into kindergarten or first grade. Take time to make the right choice and pick the right school. Don't change every time something bad happens, right? That same study published by Michigan State University talked about every time kids change, they fall further behind, even if they chose a quote-unquote better school. Of course they do, right? Like, the instability in the kids' lives, instability in the school, that hurts everything. So I would say that both on, when we talk about we have instability in DPS and EA at the system level, but I think this whole school choice stuff in Detroit, we got 20 years of school choice. School choice is very alive. Like, I want to push on this. Like, it's here to stay. It's not doing well right now. Right? Like, parents and families can't actually access the schools they want to. They can't get there in a stable way. Schools have no idea. Every time DPS, when you read those Detroit news articles into October, that DPS still has no idea how many kids they have. That's all a symptom of this churn that's happening and kids just moving around. That's a broken system, and it's not serving families either.
Steve? Oh, Steve, if you can work your way up.
They better let my co-pilot say something.
A 20-year transition phase.
That's it? That's what I was going to say. I was advocating for you. That's it?
I also want to ask, how many people in here have taken calculus? Raise your hand very high. Thank you.
Okay, I think your L is cut off.
Okay, so I actually do have a question, and my question does segue into what this woman is saying. First of all, I get that choice schools is a part of the education fabric. What you haven't talked about is the for-profit issue, but I don't want to talk about that. Because one of the things that we don't talk about is instruction, achievement. Okay, and all the governance structures are important, but so is academic leadership.
Absolutely.
And I recently was able to belong to a group called Michigan Educator Voice Fellowship, which really takes some of the best educators in this state, from West Michigan, from Detroit, from everywhere, and tries to elevate the conversation about teaching and learning. What is it going to take for this state, you're right, to create a strong plan, a strong governance plan around teaching and learning? It's going to take one thing, and that is really, really good, strong leadership that understands the nature of a classroom.
Or that understands,
and I yes, and that elevates, and I don't know if this is the C word, the curriculum, but I tell you, there is such disparate voices right now among teachers because we don't have these opportunities. So the Common Core, which we have not talked about, is being vilified, and it could lift us up, but we don't have the leadership at the state level and in the schools to create school organizations that help us as teachers teach kids the skills they need, especially reading and math, to be successful. And unless those conversations include what it's going to take to create not just pockets of isolated excellence, but a really sustainable, scalable plan that elevates teaching and learning, I just think these conversations become circular. Thank you. And they're very upsetting for those of us that really know how kids are suffering.
So let's break this apart a little bit. First, address the leadership issue, Representative.
Okay. I'm sorry. I just want to make sure that I'm talking to you. Some of your points are very heartfelt. It is the frustration that served as a catalyst for me again to run for office. But by the nature of a number of my colleagues, by the nature of a number of educators around the state that deem themselves helpless or taking control or taking the lead by taking over government, we have to get there by more of us stepping up. Because people who are making decisions about our classrooms, about our career, about our pay, about our healthcare benefits, about our pension, they don't care. They're looking at profit centers as opposed to the passion and the real reason that we went into the classroom in the first place. So that's why it's more important for us now to take the lead on that and not wait for anybody that is in the legislature to do that for us. Also, we have to hold our universities and colleges more accountable. When I went into the, I'm a graduate of Wayne State with a bachelor's and a master's. But I came back and I talked to almost 15 deans in the College of Education, trying to share with them that we ought to do a better job with the cohort of teachers that we're putting out, making sure that we bring them back, give the support that's necessary, empower them, and then make them even stronger leaders so they can support new teachers that are coming into the classroom. Further, let's look at what we really are providing in the classroom and how that matches what that inscription that when you walk in the College of Education that talks to their dedication of educating urban children. There's a huge disconnect of what I had in my textbook from what I found when I walked in the room. And if I wasn't able to shift gears and be able to provide the support that was necessary to children who oftentimes did not have a parent, they were living with grandparents who were tired and who were broken down. There were students who have parents who are in prison. And so there are students who have parents who are on drugs. And so the teacher is not just the teacher. The teacher becomes the parent, the social worker, and then these systems of choice siphon all the resources away from our public education institutions. So I would say that more of us have to take the lead and not wait for somebody to fix education for us.
Chastity, did you want to add something?
Thank you. And I like to talk a lot about Massachusetts because I spent some time there. Massachusetts, the leadership and their school reform act, which was 20 years ago, was the business community on a lot of levels. You had the business community saying, look, Massachusetts is not doing as good as we want to. Education is going to be the key. And at that time, 1993, we're talking about Michigan and Massachusetts were about level on the nation's report card. Now they lead the country, and on international tests, they're up there with the Asian countries. And their reform act is based on a curriculum model framework that was, yes, the framework for smarter balanced. And what they did in 1993 when they came up with this reform act, it was educational, it was funding reform. They began to give more money to poor districts. They changed their whole funding model. So it wasn't just about what was in the classroom, but how do you fund and support that curriculum for our classroom? And yes, they implemented an exit exam. If you can't pass this test, you can't graduate from our schools. Their test was very, very, very hard. And for years, kids did very poorly. 27-28% passed that test. Now, just about everybody is passing it on the first go round, but they stuck with it, even though their kids were doing very, very badly, from the poor kids in the ghetto to the white kids in the suburbs. They were flunking this test. They don't do so badly anymore. Massachusetts is leading the way. What we need to understand is they had a plan. The business community that funds the campaigns for
government,
the legislature, and the governor led this charge in a big way. So we have to pay attention to what the business leaders here in Michigan want to do and what they are willing to fund.
Well, the thing that's interesting about Massachusetts, too, is that even with their reforms and the progress they've made, they're still battling an achievement gap. And that's with everything they've thrown at this.
They still have an achievement gap, but look at this. The poor kids in Massachusetts score the same as our regular income kids in Michigan in math.
So, and that should be a concern to everyone. When you put it in that framework, it's like, okay, so it's not just about Detroit schools, as you said earlier, it's Michigan. We're looking at a Michigan problem. So if we limit it to Detroit and it's just about this problem that's just about Detroit, this is a Detroit problem, we're missing out on an opportunity to improve educational standards for all the kids in Michigan, and that's an issue. And I just want a quick reminder to everybody, we have roughly half an hour left or so. So try to keep your questions as short as possible so we can fit in as many. We're going to come here, we'll go across there, and then we'll come to you. And then we'll come back.
Yeah, my daughter was in Chrysler School after my wife was killed, and I went to her teacher and said, look, you should be drilling the kids under our math facts. And she said, why, no, Mr. Deakins, that's your responsibility. Well, $120,000 later in Eton Academy and Royal Oak and four trips up to Royal Oak and back every day, and Kumon, she ended up being the best female mathematician in that special ed school. But that's a lot of money, don't you think? It broke me, okay? So I'm a little bit upset with what happened because I couldn't afford to keep forking out $25,000 a year to have her go all the way through high school. So my daughter went to King, and I worked to get the kids to China, and we got them to China, and I helped pay for Chastity's trip to China. And so I carried the money to the bank every day. So, but the thing that bothers me in watching this whole thing evolve and the EM come in is that we now have a debt, and you're quite wrong, Mr. Dagnago. Chastity said it earlier today on the Mildred Gaddis show, the debt is $1 billion. So we brought in an emergency manager, and they took a $200 million debt, and they ran it right on up to $1 billion. Isn't that wonderful? And they dumped it right on the black people of Detroit. That's just fantastic. Too loud?
Question, yeah, your question.
Okay. So the question is, we had a corrupt situation, and Chastity pointed it out. Oh, these buildings cost two times the normal amount. Well, what was happening here?
So your question is, what's at the core of the corruption?
No, just give me a second here.
Okay.
Well, now,
who was ahead of this effort?
Who was the person that ran the debt up to $1 billion? Who was it? Tell me. Don't you know?
You seem to. Why don't you tell us who you think it was?
He was John Rakolta. So do you have a moral issue with John Rakolta heading up this committee when he ran the debt up to $1 billion?
Okay,
so there was this $1.5 billion bond, and then following that in 2012, we got the $500 million bond. That's $2 billion worth of construction bonds in the last generation to improve schools in Detroit, and there were two, three big companies that got a lot of that money, but to say he ran it up, he didn't get the money. If you get a contract, somebody's got to give it to you. So there have been stories upon stories about how that money was squandered because half those buildings are closed, gone, and we're still paying for them as taxpayers. But at this time, you got to look at that coalition for Detroit school children that John Rakolta is serving on. From top to bottom, there are people involved in that have been involved in Detroit public schools in lots of different ways, as contractors, as funders in some regards. And, you know, to just say he ran up the deficit or he ran up the debt, everybody in the room was complicit in that.
Okay, well, we're going to have to go ahead.
Hi, my name is Bruce, and I'm a recovering assessment expert. Between 1994 and 2003, I worked for the Michigan Educational Assessment Program. So I got that wonderful label of I'm a MEEPer, okay? My particular area happens to be social studies, but this is a comment about the whole situation there. I want to go back to what my colleague said about educational leadership. In the Department of Education, when I was there, the annual budget for the assessment office was $10 million. The annual budget for the curriculum office, our counterpart, was $1.5 million. You can do the math, okay? That ratio has to be turned around. We don't need MEEP tests in this state. We need the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Each state says that's the gold standard, and you don't have to assess every kid. The golden rule of creating an assessment is that if you're doing an assessment to help kids improve their learning, the assessment has to be designed to do that. meet tests or not. The national assessment is not. It's there to compare states, not students. Right. Thank you.
Well, we don't have a meet test any longer. We don't have that. But Armin, talk a little bit about this assessment piece. And you know, when we look at Detroit schools, and I know you all are doing the scorecard, but the assessment piece for the kids, how is that driving how Detroit is moving forward in its education policy?
I don't think anybody knows what we have right now. So we overtest our kids, no doubt. We have a state test. The local districts and charter schools have their assessments that are different. There's a NAEP exam that's every other year just with Detroit Public Schools, not the other schools. There's all kinds of surveys. There's site visits. There's all kinds of stuff going on. To Chastity's earlier point, I actually think we should have assessments. I think we should know how schools are performing, and I think educators need to know how their kids are performing, and there's lots of reasons to have this. The problem is, again, kind of instability, inconsistency. Like, it would be great to pick an assessment, good, bad, or ugly, and stick with it for a decade, like Massachusetts did, so people can build curriculum around it, and you know what standards you're trying to reach. And you know that you can't get a kid there overnight, by the way. It's going to take 12 years or 15 years in early childhood as part of that. Like, but we keep moving the target, and nobody can work in that environment. So back to the educator piece. Like, I haven't been an educator, but I've got all kinds of educators in my family, right? Like, and Mary, I've watched you as an educator. Like, I've watched lots.
And you know a lot. It's
Yeah, but thank you. My observation is it's really hard to be an educator when everything's constantly changing around you and the standards are changing and your leadership is changing and the budget is changing. Like, at some point, that instability just churns good people away and makes it really hard to ever know if you're improving. Like, what's your target? What are you trying to? And by the way, like, when we haven't. So we're not going to solve poverty in Detroit. Like, let's be clear about that. But when you can't even create stable housing for families, right? So kids are moving around, or you don't have stable transportation, so kids can't get to school, and they're showing up late. And, you know, all of that impacts it too. So I think that this assessment piece is part of a much bigger problem, which is, what is the master plan, and can we pick one, and can we stick with it for a while?
Thank you. First of all, I want to say that this is so much fun to be here because I've been working on my dissertation for months and months and months in my home office without any kind of contact with people, and here I am now, and it's great. And my dissertation is on school reform in Detroit in the last 30 years. So, we have to talk. And there's so many people that I want to talk to in this room. But so first I have a comment, and then there's a question. And so the comment is that I'm looking at school reform from a historical perspective. And so what we see is that in the early 20th century, we had the progressive era movement. And this is, you know, imagine Detroit. It's being built, and it's hustling, bustling, and wealth is coming in because of the industry. And there was actually a great movement to transform a village school system into a large urban school system. So one of the things that I'm finding in my dissertation, one of my findings, is that we might be actually in another new era where there is mass transformation. And a lot of the conflict that we're feeling, the rub and the stress and the tension, is actually because we're entering into a new era of schooling. So my question is, if that is the case, hypothetically, if that's the situation, what do we do to create more political capacity across various people so that we can actually, build a new system together? Because we're at the 21st century, and it's been disrupted by these past 30 years of policies. What do we need to do politically to bring people together to build the school system?
Representative.
Thank you, and I'm so glad to see you as well, and looking forward to your final report that you'll have coming out. I still say we have to have more people who are committed to education to take the lead on ed policy. There are a number of people, and of course I agree that a number of people can talk about education, but until you've actually been in the classroom and witnessed firsthand the various challenges and nuances and obstacles and all of the varying needs and understanding the personality of the students and answering the needs that come from Central, that have been pushed down from the administrator of the building. Until we understand that, there's something missing between what a general layperson's understanding is and a person that is in the actual building, in the driver's seat. There's nothing that I could say if I was the engineer of a plane. If I've never flown a plane and felt the turbulence and had to save the plane before it potentially crashed or had an incident that holds the lives of people in the palm of my hands, I've never experienced that. So it's the same feeling as an educator. And so that's why many of us are so passionate, because we know what it's like to have 35 lives in our hands. 40. And then have to shift your expectations, evaluate and assess while you are serving the needs of another child who may not be on that level. And so it's not as simple and black and white as many people try to make it out to be when we talk about a plan for improving academic achievement. Yes, we need to establish a plan, but I can't say it enough that it has to be more educators involved in that process. And it will take many of us going to the legislature, serving on the education committee. Now, look at this. I came from 9.5 years working for Detroit City Council. I left and I simultaneously got my teaching certification. I went into the classroom, and then I was recruited from the classroom to come to United Way. And so I worked with this guy right next to me for about 6 months. I did. And so we started together with the whole infrastructure of evaluating schools and providing parents with a resource to better educate them on schools. Now, I have my own thoughts about what should go into that metrics of how we actually evaluate schools, but that's the teacher voice. Teacher voice is not really present in a lot of instances, and so I'm not demonizing ESD or United Way or any other organization, but far too often, educators have not been a part of those processes. Until we make sure that they are, we'll continue getting what we have right now.
Name Leanne. I recognize you. Real quickly, I just want to say, and going back to Massachusetts, when you talk to the people who led that reform, they will say, you will not see school reform because it's the right thing to do for children. You will not see school reform because of some altruistic, kumbaya, let's all get along reasons. It's economic. And when you can convince people across different party lines that this is good for everyone, right, then it will be a trickle-down effect to those who are least politically able to do these things for themselves.
And we saw that with early education, right? We saw this investment in early education that was driven by the business community saying, look, when we look out at employability in 20 years, we don't have a workforce that we're going to be able to employ. So we've got to make some investments in early education in Michigan. But the other thing I would say, and I don't usually answer questions at these things, but it's something that we see in our reporting. Chastity said something earlier on about how kids in Massachusetts who are the most impoverished, the most at risk, are performing better than kids who are considered average here in Michigan. In State of Opportunity, we run into this issue where people think the stories we're telling are about other people's kids. It's all happening over there. I don't go to Detroit. I don't visit Detroit. I don't visit Flint. I don't visit, you know, wherever. That's not my world. That's not my community. And in Michigan, we have to understand that what impacts Detroit does impact Grand Rapids. Yes. It does impact Ann Arbor. It does impact Canton. So that's not so much kumbaya as it is just practicality. And somehow the state has got to have a come to Jesus thing that if Detroit is failing, it's pulling everybody down. And if our best prepared kids in Michigan are not, if they're not performing as well as kids in Massachusetts, everybody in Michigan is behind the ball. That's just what it is. It's a political reality. And that message, for some reason, has not penetrated upward the way it should. But that's what we're dealing with.
Michigan is performing in the bottom third of all states on the NAEP. And if Detroit is the most socially or economically troubled, then it's the indicator for Michigan. And we're in the bottom third. The state is in the bottom third. What do you expect?
My biggest problem, though, is when you look at the list of persistently low-performing schools across the state, we have Detroit, who the only city or the only districts whose schools were put into the EAA system. But when I asked the head of the reform office a couple of weeks ago, just how many persistently low-performing schools do we have across the state? It's 138. So why was the selection, and they weren't in order? Detroit didn't have the lowest 5% of all of the total schools that were persistently low performing. So we have to be honest about how that was motivated. And it's motivated because it's the largest district in a community predominantly of color, and it's continued to feed off of poverty. How long will the state feed off of poverty? We have to change this narrative, and we have to change it by being fair and equitable across the state. And you're right. As long as we keep feeding off of the least, the whole state is going to lag and suffer.
So how do you bring that argument to Lansing?
I continue every day having dialogue. I got sworn in on January the 14th. The people that are working with me think something's wrong because I haven't stopped yet. But I got sworn in on the 14th, and on the 16th, we had a legislative tour. Well, we brought 25 civic leaders together, many of them from other parts of Michigan that came down, senators, representatives, and some of the city and Wayne County commissions all came, and we toured a number of Detroit public schools. They read in the news all the time that we have no good schools. Poor Detroit. Detroit's failing. There are no good schools. I took them to Flix. I took them to Adult Ed West. We took them to a number of schools that have a number of great programs, and they said, wow, I didn't know this existed. I didn't know little black kids could speak Chinese. I didn't know. That's what they said. And so we got to be real and not be afraid to have this open dialogue around how we see things differently. And then now we change that by sitting down with each other. I went to church Sunday morning, me and my mom, with Tristan Cole, about 20 minutes from Shanty Creek, Bel Air, Michigan. He's a Republican on the other side. But I talked to him about my views and my values for education. And so it's one relationship at a time, one conversation at a time. Because at the end of the day, whether Republican or Democrat, whether white or black, we all want the best for our children. And sometimes it's being willing to have the conversations that Michigan, for some reason, has had a very challenging time having for a number of years.
Steve, was there a question in the back? Yeah.
Hi. So there's a lot of pressure. Hey, Armin. I got it, I think. There's a lot of pressure on educators these days to make data-driven decisions. That seems to be one of the big mantras. There's a lot of good reason for it. You've mentioned some of the reasons that some of the assessments that we're doing are worthwhile. But the policy that's being made right now is not data-driven. So I want to give you a couple of examples. The best systems in the world and in this country actually don't offer school choice. They're centralized. And they make centralized decisions around a centralized curriculum. And they make sure that every kid going to every school has a great teacher in every classroom. And they do that in part by directing resources towards developing teachers rather than paying tons and tons of money for assessments, as you mentioned. So my question is, and this is stuff that's unequivocal. This, all the data points that way. So my question is, why is it that we're making decisions at the policy level that are actually not supported by data at all. No one seems to be interested in evidence. No one seems to be interested in knowing what the best practices are. There are systems around the world and around this country who have done this really effectively. We're going the other way. So I'm trying to understand from a policy place why that's the case.
I don't think you all, great comments, but I don't think you all are hearing me. We have to have more educators at the table influencing the agenda, driving the agenda, developing the agenda. That's the way we change this.
But Representative, that's going to take time. So I mean, we're talking about elections.
But if we get more organized, if our labor organizations, AFT, MEA, and all of these leadership, BFT, DFT, if you get the educational practitioners together. Now, Chastity spoke early. I don't think you heard her because I told you all. I told her to repeat it because I wanted you to hear how decisions are influenced by business people writing checks. So roll out those campaign reports and see who's writing the checks. Then you'll see who they have to answer to. So when Dick DeVos tell our leaders or our legislators what to do, they vote accordingly. But if our educators pull together their resources and support members to run and take those seats, they then seize the power.
Chastity,
and that's what has to happen.
You wanted to jump in.
I was going to say that. We had a big Supreme Court case about dark money. Money, contributions to campaigns, and voters move politicians. We know that. We know that. So and to speak to your question, again, I would submit that from studying all these other states, we do not have a plan in Michigan. So our policy is rudderless.
Yes, go ahead, Steve. We got a question in the back.
All right, this gentleman's been waiting very patiently.
Thank you.
Well, actually, he was before me.
Well, okay, Okay.
I'm going to make this really succinct. My father graduated from Northwestern High School illiterate. He was pushed through the system. He taught himself to read to be able to teach me to read so that I had a fighting chance. My question is, how do we get parents involved so that they are promoting the education of their children? Because despite what we think, education doesn't start at school. It starts at home. And until we can get parents to get involved and actually educate their children, how do we expect children to want to learn?
Who wants to tackle that one? Because I think one of the issues that we've run into with our reporting is that, A, parents do want their kids to learn, but also you're talking about parents who have often gone through the same system their kids are going through and have felt disconnected from that system. They don't feel empowered to be a part of their kids' education. So that's part of it. Go ahead, Chastity.
Well, I have tried to write about parental involvement in so many different kinds of capacities that I just gave up because it matters, of course, but whether you're a parent who does not get involved or whether you're an over-involved parent, that child still has to learn. That teacher still has to teach that kid. You know, so we can say it's the parents' fault. Okay, maybe it is. We still have to teach the kid. The kid still has to graduate. I think that's a circular conversation. Everybody can have in their own school with their own community. But I don't think that conversation has ever led us to any resolution as far as academic achievement is concerned.
Armin, did you want to add anything? And you can say no. That's an answer.
You know, I want to just connect the dots here, this new era that you spoke about, and you pointed out your brother pushed through the system. I mean, you know, with having not been able to read, right? It was your mother, your father, right? Father, sorry. That might have been okay back then, and it's not anymore, and that's a good thing. And we wouldn't know that unless there was accountability on the system. So now that said, like, we aren't resourcing it enough to actually educate all of our kids in these schools, right? Like, it used to be okay for half the kids to drop out and go get factory jobs. It's not okay anymore. So there is this new era where every single school is being expected to educate 100% of the kids to be ready for college or career. Like, that's a new era. That might cost different. That might look different. But listen, we assess school performance all the time, and I'm not in love with the tests that we have, but part of that is because we're constantly using them to beat people up. But there is this part of this that, like, that should never have happened, right? Like, you should not be able to move grade to grade to grade to grade and graduate and be illiterate. And the fact that that used to happen, like, I think we're in a better, like, this new era might be really hard, but I think it's a better era that we're trying to go to. It's a much higher expectation. But that's, like, I think that we spend a lot of time around these tables trying to lay blame on whose fault that was. Like, I think we need to start thinking about, like, we're heading into this, I just love this, like, this is a different set of expectations, a different era. Like, what's it going to take? And by the way, it's going to take more and a different set of inputs than it used to. And we should just be prepared for that and be honest about that.
Bridge Magazine.
Stop blaming.
Bridge Magazine, we did an interview with Mike Flanagan, who's the outgoing state superintendent, and we talked to him about what we found in other states and why isn't Michigan doing this and when are we going to do that. And he said that Michigan is 10 years behind states that are moving ahead. Michigan is 10 years behind now, so it's going to take us 10 years to catch up if we come up with a set of strategies.
We can speed that transition by reducing class sizes and supporting educators in the classroom, and by making sure that one of the greatest indicators it is that will improve academic achievement, that parents are involved. And so I'm sorry that you experienced that, but I'm glad you had a dad that made sure that he helped get you through. And as a teacher, a science teacher, that would have six classes of sixth through eighth graders, and during parent-teacher conference, only 10 or 15% that would show up. I understand that many of them felt disenfranchised, but at the same token, we have a responsibility to provide support, but also a system of accountability for parents to take ownership and to support their children's learning.
You have time for one more question? Okay.
Okay, so I'm looking around the room, and I see many of you with your devices out, and that's so great. And if the rest of you could grab them, then I can help you out for just a second here. I'm actually here tonight with Dr. Petroni back there. My name is Karen Toomey. I'm on a board of education and an educator. Good to see you, Chastity and Sherry. Armin, nice presenting to your coalition not too long ago. So if everybody has their devices out and you want to just Google Detroit Data and Democracy, that is a website that we've been putting together in order to provide some of the information that people have been asking for. I know that Sherry and others have been talking the room about the necessity to get out the information about the other narrative, about the actual data, and you can go through and you can look at when the actual public acts were passed, what the value of the bonds were, what the value of the deficit was, and you can follow that narrative through. And if you go to that Detroit Data and Democracy website, you can also see the presentation that we gave to the Detroit City Council. To the Detroit Board of Education. We gave it to your coalition, Armin, and then just recently to the State Board of Education. So people who are looking for a little more information, Detroit Data and Democracy. Thank you.
Thank you. So just as we're wrapping up, I want to give folks time, a chance to talk to y'all afterwards. But just to wrap up, take a couple of seconds, and from each of you, I want to hear what you see as the major barriers as we move forward. What are the things we have to deal with in order to move education in a positive direction in Detroit? Armin, I'll start with you.
First of all, thank you for having us tonight. Big conversation, difficult conversation, lots to cover in a short period. So, listen, I just leave this with, like, I'm hopeful of where we're going. I think that, so it's not my coalition. Let me just be really clear about this. And Representative is on the coalition. I'm actually not on the coalition. So that is a cross-section of individuals who have tried to put the blame behind them and try to create a future. And I think between that work and I think there is a rededication of resources, of educators, of families. Excellent Schools Detroit surveys parents in the city and teachers and students every year as part of our scorecard to get their voice about it. And we're watching family engagement go up based on the perception of families and teachers and students. Like, I think that those indicators are pointing the right way. I'm hopeful that we can do this. I just got to say, like, I think you have to put the blame behind us at some point. Like, we can keep debating the last 20 years, or we can start building the next 20 years. And I'm optimistic the coalition is doing that. It's going to be hard work, absolutely hard work, navigating the politics of that in Lansing, as they have. And I also, you know, that's Dr. Jennifer Lewis there that spoke about following data. Like, I actually think that we know more these days. Like, we have not been a reflective sector. The education sector has been driven by politics, driven by money, driven by a lot of things. There's greater and more research coming out every day about this kind of stuff, and I think we should all be informed by it. And I think you're spot on about that. And so I'm hopeful that politics behind us, past behind us, using research to guide the future, I think it's bright.
Representative?
Thank you. Thank you, Armin. I think you could clap for him. Gosh. So I'll probably tear this quote up, and Baba will help me because he's a state of Michigan winning social studies educator. But there's a quote that goes something like, "Lest we remember the past, we're destined to repeat it." I believe the origin is Jewish. But I just want to say that in these very difficult conversations, there are people who want to plow past what has happened to DPS when DPS has experienced an academic holocaust. And so it's important that we honor what has happened so that we don't repeat it. That's not to suggest that we stay there. Because by us being here tonight, this very diverse room, willing to have this very difficult conversation, it says that we can move forward. While I came to the coalition's work with much hesitation, I also came with a bit and a glimmer of hope. Hope that we can now start to develop a plan that will put children first, that will put academic achievement first, and not the politics that have fed off of our system first. And in order to get there, we have to have real, honest dialogue about the people that have helped to cause it. So I honor what you said, and I know what you said. So moving forward, I'm hopeful. But more than that, I hope that I serve as an example of how educators must seize leadership and not allow anyone to make decisions about policy for us. The interesting thing is there's such a push against us, so when we fight harder, they say we're too radical, we're too loud. But I'm one of few teachers, new teachers elected to come to the legislature, but I've been blocked from the education committee. But that doesn't stop my resolve and my fight to ensure that I fight on behalf of the children of the state of Michigan, not just in my district, that I fight on behalf of Detroit public schools and not those that have fed off of it. We can do this. We can do this. But we must be willing to work together, put our lens aside, and hear from each other and take the truth, because truth is not restricted by title. Truth will prevail if we all have the will, the political will, and the social will to advance what's right for our children. So I'm inspired. I'm very hopeful. And seeing all of you here, I'm charged up even more. Yes, we can.
Chastity.
Oh, you got a mic.
You should have went last. Right. So my research and other states have shown that in order to move forward, there has to be a realization that academic achievement is an economic necessity. We are not doing as well as we want to think we are in Michigan. It's not just about Detroit. So once there's this realization that academic achievement is an economic necessity, and there is a plan built around that that leads to an economic growth here in the state, that's when we'll see some growth. That's when we'll see some investment. We need to understand that other states have figured out teacher evaluations that support kids in the classroom, training for teachers, that works. Early childhood education, that works. Early literacy, that works. And out and out rigor. Make school hard. Make the conversation center around actual school, which will tie us to economic growth. That's how other states reform their school systems, and that's what works.
So I want to say thanks to Chastity, Representative Danyogo, and Armin Harachian. And just as a note, how many of you listened to This American Life? How many folks heard it this past weekend? If you didn't hear it, they did a very interesting story called 3 Miles Away. And it's a story that focuses on what they actually had when I was in high school, sort of an exchange program between a public school in the Bronx and a private school elsewhere in New York. And the impact that traveling to this private school had on these kids coming from the Bronx. And it's some of the most heartbreaking storytelling you will hear, but it's also a really incredible reminder of why it's important that all of our kids feel valued and all of our kids walk into a classroom and feel like there is a desire to educate them and to provide them with the future. So if you haven't listened, This American Life, WBEZ.org, you can connect through there. You can also connect through MichiganRadio.org. It's worth a listen to. There is an education town hall meeting with Representative Danyogo, Increasing Detroit's Pipeline at Higher Education. It's Saturday, March 21st from 9 to 11 a.m. at Wayne County Community College. I believe there are flyers circulating. So everyone, thank you so much for what was the most raucous issue in issues of the nail I've ever attended, but it was great fun. Thank you for being here. We hope to see you at the next one.